Until 2018, influential activist, curator and writer Laura Rakovich was president and executive director of Queen's Museum in New York City. She resigned after the museum cancelled its agreement to rent space for a celebration of the 70th anniversary of the independence of the State of Israel. Rakovich called the event political. She'd advocated the boycott of Israel. The cancellation caused a furore. The event went ahead and she resigned. This was the end of an embattled appointment for Rakovich, who believed the Queen's Museum had a legitimate role in protesting then-President Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies. The board did not agree, and this was the catalyst for Laura Rakovich's new book, Culture Strike, Art and Museums in an Age of Protest. She is in Manhattan in New York. She's with us now. Hello, welcome.
Hello, Kim. Lovely to be here. Good morning.
Lovely to talk to you. The board's position, just to recap on that a little, about Trump's policies, was that as a public institution, the museum could not take sides in the political debate around immigration. You say what?
Well, I say that, number one, the responsibility, the greatest responsibility of the museum was to its publics, and the publics that we served most profoundly were the immigrant populations that surrounded the museum and lived there day in and day out. And they were in great fear at that moment. Many people were not sending their children to school, had retreated, were only going out if there were two parents in the household, one was only going out at a time. Even if people had documentation, there was a great amount of fear. We're talking about very early days of the Trump presidency. And, you know, it wasn't, and I should emphasize, it wasn't the whole board. It was just a couple of members of the board who felt that it would be best to simply lay low, to continue to do the good work. They weren't necessarily Trump supporters. They were folks who just didn't want the museum to get into trouble for defending the people with whom we had collaborated for many years. So I just felt that that was an unacceptable position in the contemporary moment that we were in. And I really felt it was necessary that the museum be more forthcoming about its support for the immigrant communities around the museum.
The issue of the event celebrating the creation of Israel, you saw it as a violation of the policy of not renting space for political events. What if some of the peoples you referred to earlier were, in fact, Jews who supported the creation of Israel? Do you know what I mean? Every peoples has a position.
Sure. I just felt that in that case, it was literally the government of Israel that was seeking to rent our space. I mean, normally we did weddings and things like that. It wasn't, you know, for political, governmental state action, you know, events. So that was my opposition to that event. It was really around the fact that it was clearly related to whatever, you know, Donald Trump was negotiating with Israel. And in point of fact, a week after the event happened, or a few days after the event happened, Trump announced the moving of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So, you know, there were larger politics at stake, larger state politics at stake that I just didn't feel like the museum needed to be engaged with.
And just checking here, Laura, would you have opposed an event marking the Palestinian Intifada, for example?
No, I don't think it was, if it had been a historical look at the, if it had been a historic and not in collaboration with the state, that would have been a different thing. This was directly in response to the mission of the United Nations, the Israeli mission of the United Nations that wanted to rent the space for the event. And I just didn't feel that that was appropriate. But at the end of the day, it wasn't my decision. It was the board's decision. And they had decided that they agreed agreed with me, and then they decided that they didn't. So, right. You know, it was not my call. It was my recommendation, but I didn't make the decision. They did.
And you resigned because?
Well, I resigned for very many reasons. This was only one piece of the conversation. Sure. I resigned in part because, you know, I, being a museum director was a tough job. You know, there was a lot of money to raise, and a lot of work to be done locally in the community there. And I thought we were doing a terrific job, and the museum was on a very nice trajectory. However, I sensed that because of my position, where the staff of the museum and I decided together that we would join the art strike on inauguration day, as well as our desire to participate in a citywide program for art spaces as sanctuaries, and that I was at odds with some of the members of the board, and just the work that we had to do and that was cut out for us was too great to have that kind of resistance on something that I felt like was such an obvious thing, because the Queen's Museum had for a very long time been deeply allied with community groups, particularly immigrant groups, and other advocacy groups throughout the borough of Queens. So it was something that I felt it wasn't work that I began, but it was the work that I thought was terribly important, and also that I desired to continue.
And the art space sanctuaries, which you were mm-hmm. responsible for, that was creating a safe, as I understand it, a safe environment for immigrants among art and cultural spaces. Is that creating a safe environment? Is that... This goes to the crux of it, and a very interesting examination of it in your book, Culture Strike. Is that the museum's job? What is the job of a museum?
Well, I guess it depends on one level what type of museum you are. But at the end of the day, if you're a cultural space, you're representing in some way culture. Right. And culture engages each and every one of us and all of our complexity and identities. And it has something to do, I think, with cultural production, bringing meaning and ideas and sparking the imagination about how we might confront our contemporary realities. I mean, whether you're looking at ancient art or recent art, you're always reflecting on the art you're looking at and relating it to your own existence and life in some way, whether it's something that you feel like represents you or somehow reflects you back, or whether it makes you wonder and makes you see the world in a slightly different way than you ever might have thought. And so I think in this space of imagination, at a time where globally, particularly over the last 18 months, we've all experienced quite a global crisis in health, which has highlighted so much inequity around the globe, from very hyper-local situations to very broad transnational ones. And I think the function of culture within this moment is particularly important, because it can help us imagine better futures, better presence, better ways of being together. And that's in part the reason that I wrote this book, is because I think the museum space particularly has a proximity to the inequities that society displays. And so if we can find a way to make them better, perhaps it gives us a clue of how to do that in a larger society.
And you say that because museums tend to be expressions of privilege.
Well, I think that they display the dynamics that take place in society, where you have, especially in the United States, because the funding for museums largely comes from private sources, particularly from private individuals, you have board members who are very wealthy, that come from great, great wealth and privilege, who are funding work that... That takes place in a variety of different registers, including, you know, very equity-minded educational programming and very scholarly-minded curatorial programming and everything in between. So, you know, there are people at the museum who earn very little money, and, you know, very, uh, you know, low wages and barely make ends meet, and directors who make a great deal more, never mind the board members who are volunteers because of their wealth and resources. So just in the sense, in a purely like socioeconomic sense, you have this breadth of representation of the way that society is reflected directly within the museum.
Is it possible, Laura, to mm-hmm. see the status quo, which you could argue many, many museums and indeed art galleries put on show, is it possible to see the status quo as a situation that society has chosen democratically?
Well, I think we may have chosen it, but I'm not sure we've chosen it democratically. because I think that, the great imbalances of wealth and power that are exhibited across the globe are not necessarily democratic. And the consolidation of wealth and power that we've seen over the last several decades in particular has been quite extreme, with so much of the globe's wealth falling in the hands of a very, very few number of people, and therefore the power that goes alongside that. So I think that it may have been chosen, but it's been chosen by an increasingly small number of people.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, and this goes to another subject that you tackle in your book, and it's about appropriation, repatriation mm-hmm. of art. For example, what the world knows as the Elgin marbles, you pointedly call them the Acropolis marbles. Mm-hmm. They should be returned. And appropriation in another sense, being behind objections, for example, to Dana Schutz's painting of Emmett Till in the coffin. Now, talk me through that controversy, please.
The Emmett Till one?
Yes.
So Dana Schutz is a white painter who's a renowned American painter. And she exhibited a painting called, I'm just blanking on the name of the painting, but in any case, Open Casket, sorry.
That's right.
She made a painting called Open Casket, which was based on an image that Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mother, made public back when Emmett Till was murdered, because she wanted the world to see what her child had been put through, who had been tortured and killed during the civil rights era in the United States for supposedly having been a black boy in the American South, and supposedly having kind of said something inappropriate to a white woman in a shop. And this woman has since, she's still alive, she's since said that this event didn't, you know, she lied about it, that he never said anything to her. But at the time, a group of white vigilantes, badly beat Emmett Till to death, and it was really one of a nadir of race relations in the United States, because of the obvious brutality against this completely innocent child. And his mother made this decision to make the image public through Jet magazine, and there is a very moving installation in the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., about this incident, and it still has profound resonance in the U.S. And, Dana Schutz made a painting of this photo from this photograph, and, her sort of brushstrokes, of his ruined, this child's ruined face were kind of abstracted. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with the painting itself, from a painterly perspective, although certainly other paintings of hers that I have liked better. But the use of that imagery, there has been a great debate over the use of that imagery. Because it is seen as a white person, once again, profiting in some way from the pain and degradation of Black people, or a particular Black person being Emmett Till. And so great debates swirled around this work and around the Whitney at the time. And my interest in this controversy is not so much about specifically about the appropriation of the image, although obviously that plays into it, but also about a museum's response to that and how cultural space is or is not attuned to the impact of showing a work like this. And in part, the question becomes, you know, who is making the choices about what works are going on view? Who is that curatorial staff? Or is there anyone on that team who might say, well, you know, some folks might interpret this painting in such and so way. We might want to be prepared for that, or even questioning whether the work should be included in the show for various reasons. And to have really robust conversations like that, you need very diverse, you know, staffs of institutions. And then on another level, once a controversy, let's say, breaks out, what is the institutional response to that? Is there an openness to discussing, you know, the core of the matter, or is it more defensive? Is there a kind of, and I understand this because I've worked inside museums and cultural institutions for a long time. There's this, you know, everybody feels very vulnerable in cultural spaces that, you know, your funding is dependent on all kinds of things. And what you want to do is kind of always appear to be doing the right thing. And so, you know, you don't want to necessarily admit a mistake or a failure of some kind. And this is a real problem because, you know, we all make mistakes. And, you know, if we are all striving to make the world a more equitable place or someplace that's better for more people, we're going to venture into spaces that that we're going to need to make ourselves vulnerable and say, hey, you know what, I made a mistake. So, you know, I think that to me, that example of a controversy in a museum is interesting for those reasons, as well as the appropriation piece, in part because, you know, I think many people thought, well, you know, a white, you know, there was a lot of debate whether a white artist even had the right to depict this image. But I think it goes even beyond that question to these larger structural things that say, well, that point out that, you know, had there perhaps been a greater diversity of voices looking at the works, that perhaps, you know, other decisions would have been made.
You mean other decisions? You mean not showing it?
Well, or perhaps picking a different work, or maybe just even presenting the work slightly differently, you know, explaining it, you know, contextualizing it differently.
But why, as an artist, I mean, do you not worry that so heightened are the sensitivities surrounding race, gender, colonialism, Israel, that there is nothing that can be merely shown to the general public or publics without somebody insisting on a certain context? Does that not worry you?
What worries me is that images are incredibly powerful, and that the way that we use images, particularly in art and in cultural space, impact people in very profound ways. And so as cultural producers in museums, we have to be very thoughtful about who our audiences are and to whom we're presenting that work, and to make sure that we're thinking it through. I'm not saying they should not have shown the painting. I think that's their choice, obviously. I'm not interested in censorship here. What I am interested in is having a plethora of conversation and internal discourse about who, with a group of people who actually can speak to these questions before the work is put out. And then if controversy does hit, then actually have a very robust public discourse about what that means. Because I think that we can all learn from these things if we enter into, and as you point out, I think it's very difficult to have conversations once things get super heated. So we have to figure out ways to take the temperature down and actually be able to channel these very important objections that people have to the ways in which predominantly white institutions are framing the histories that we see in such instances.
I'm talking to Laura Rakovich about her book, Culture Strike, Art and Museums in an Age of Protest. You reference another book in your book, Anand Giridharadas' book, Winners Take All, which is a critique of elitist philanthropy. We spoke to him a little while ago. You mm-hmm. want to abolish the philanthropic model, do you, of museums?
I wouldn't say that because I think that the cultural world in the United States doesn't have, it wouldn't be possible to abolish the philanthropic model. What I would like to do is rebalance the philanthropic model by rebalancing it with public support. I think in the United States, we've never actually had a national conversation about culture. We don't have a national culture ministry. We don't have a national federal federal government level cultural policy outside of the very incapacity National Endowment for the Arts, which is always on the chopping block. And so therefore can't have a proper conversation about what regular people want from culture and how museums and cultural spaces fit into that. And until we have that, the very significant tax write-offs that that wealthy people can receive for major contribution for any contributions to nonprofit organizations in the U.S. The public has given that that tax write-off has given the power to make decisions over where those funds are given to the private sector, and I don't think we recognize that anymore as a public. As a public source of funds, and so we have to reclaim that and actually rebalance a bit. And I think that's a big piece of the question.
Is it? I mean, the Sackler family have been exposed as mm-hmm. being, behind the opiate epidemic and huge funders of all sorts of public institutions. Would you make them take all their money back? I don't know whether Queen's was in receipt of any Sackler money.
The Queen's Museum never received Sackler funds, but I do think that that the name should be removed at this point. I think enough has come out that people really understand the impact that this family very directly had on the opioid crisis. I think that the issue is not necessarily the money they gave, but the reputational support that they received from the good
sure.
feeling and the
good. I mean, if they'd given the money anonymously, then that would have been fine. If they'd given the money on condition that their name not be used, that would have been fine. It's the laundering of the name via the money that you
exactly,
objected.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And also just, there are many other circumstances, that bear looking at. It's not, the Sacklers are not alone in this, theirs is a pretty vast and pretty public at this point. There are many other major philanthropists who have been involved in, let's just say, icky things. it's really about contending with those realities, and that, as we were talking about before, the consolidation of wealth and power comes at a very real cost, and that real cost is levied upon the backs of the people who don't have access to that power. And if we are going to have any hope of even minor recalibrations of that in society, we have to start there.
But how to get to where you think museums should be? I mean, there are people who have said explicitly, it's too broken to fix. You can't
yeah.
just fiddle with it, You just, pull them down, start again. What?
Well, I think that, there are always going to be people who think that it should just be torn down and started over with. But I guess I'm a bit of a conservationist. And I think too much intellectual and human resources have been put into establishing these institutions, as flawed as they might be. And also, they're not all the same. I mean, I think probably one of the most beautiful things about living in New York City is the vast range of cultural spaces that we encounter here. And the kind of beauty of being able to encounter, the Metropolitan Museum of Art and a community art center in the Bronx in the same day. So just let's just say they're not the same. However, I do think that one thing could be done by every single institution that's out there, and that is slowing down. Because I think part of the problem that all institutions face in terms of, you know, how they work is that, you know, we're on this endless treadmill of having to do more, better, faster, stronger. And that doesn't necessarily lead to good decision making, right? And if we had more time to actually make sure we had the right people in the room to make certain decisions and to, you know, to make sure that all of our, you know, that we're really making the right choices, I think that that would make a huge difference. And it's sounds like such a stupid thing, but it's like, it actually is very difficult to achieve.
Well, I was going to say nigh impossible. I mean, your right choice is somebody's wrong choice. I mean, you're aware and you've written that a lot of people are scared, unnerved to say the least right now, a lot of white people in particular. And some of the texts I'm receiving from listeners illustrate this. For example, I'm turning the radio off. I can't listen to this PC sanitized crap. We are not stupid. We make our own minds up when looking at art in museums. And of course, we shouldn't take money from the bad guys, but this is a different conversation. And what a joke. She's obviously in favour of censorship, they say, of you, and so on and so forth. You're trying to change what people see as important and beautiful and to some extent inarguable. How do you do that?
Well, I think what we have to understand is that it's not as though the museum and the cultural space was neutral from the get-go, you know? Every organization has a founding story. Most collections were founded on the basis of one particular person's personal taste. And those collections were then gifted to some institution, and then generations of people studied them, and that's what became excellent. And it's like, if there was one person who'd made those choices, those are very individual decisions. It's not just automatic that that work was excellent. It went through a process, right? And so in acknowledging that, we have to acknowledge that the vast majority of human experience is left out of what that person or that very small group of people's taste was. And there's no reason to think that there isn't excellence outside of that. And so what does it take to actually reassemble how we think about what we see in the world, to not only to imagine a much broader space of excellence? And, you know, look, I don't mind being called PC or whatever. You know, I think that I it's not about that. It's really about shifting a worldview that has been very much focused on a white and, you know, European white way of storytelling and categorization, and also, frankly, about the domination of those ideas as the prime ones. And I think for me, as a person, as a white woman who has seen this my entire life and has, you know, and has identified parts of my education that were like specifically in keeping with that, I now recognize that that was also, you know, only a part of the story. And so once we begin to recognize that, and this is why the museum piece is important, is because if museums and cultural spaces tell stories, well, they can tell all kinds of stories, right? And so that's why I think that cultural space is particularly important to this.
As you pointed out, you're a cis, straight, white woman of a certain type of education. Did you have an epiphany?
No. I think I just sort of came at it over time. You know, I came of age in the United States, you know, went to college in the mid-90s. And, you know, that was a time everyone was reading Edward Said and, you know, talking multiculturalism was extremely important to the discourse at that moment. And to me, it was very logical, having come from an immigrant family who, you know, didn't, and having lived in a couple of different countries as a child, you know, to me, that seemed obvious. That seemed like that was correct. And having had friends of many different, you know, ethnic and racial backgrounds over my life, I, you know, to me, that was that enriched me in many ways more than I ever, their participation in my life was really enriching to me personally. So I had very like personal, relationships that impacted my thinking on this.
I think that more recently, after you resigned from Queen's, you became involved in a museum of queer art. Is that right?
Yes, I was the temporary director of the Leslie Lohman Museum of Art, which is a queer art museum in Soho, based in Soho, in New York. And a friend of mine, Gonzalo Casals, had been the director there, and he became the commissioner of cultural affairs for New York City. And I became the interim director, but I was very clear that I thought, and the board was with me as well, we were in agreement that, you know, I would only serve temporarily because we both felt a queer person should be at the helm. In part because, for obvious reasons, but also because it was the museum is of a scale and scope that it's particularly a perfect stepping stone, as with Gonzalo, for larger positions.
So do you think that we're looking at a whole range of museums to cater for various identities? You know, you could have a queer museum, you could have an immigrant museum, you could have a colonial museum, you could have a museum for old white people who don't like not being white and imperial. Do you know what I mean?
I think we already have those.
But doesn't that worry you? I mean, shouldn't a museum be a space where we all come together and take different things from the same things?
Absolutely, but it's already that, Kim. It's already that. You know, if you're Nigerian and from Benin, and you walk into the room where the Benin bronzes are in Paris, and you've never seen them before because there are none left in your country, and because you're visiting Paris, you feel very differently about that experience than I would. So I think. Yeah, I mean that's just this idea of the universal is so appealing. It's like this Enlightenment idea that we can all come into this kind of neutral space and appreciate the art for its abstract meaning is all well and good until you have a very personal relationship with that piece of artwork. And then things get flipped on their heads, because then it brings in the history of that object or the history of that image in the way that Emmett Till's image or the way that a Benin bronze might relate to your life in a very particular way.
Very interesting. Very interesting interview. Very interesting book. Thank you, Laura. Laura Rakovic, whose book is called Culture Strike: Art and Museums in an Age of Protest. Suffice it to say that that interview was polarising for you, if you're still there. Some of you aren't. So polarising was it?